of perturbative QCD or asymptotic freedom, the fact that the quarks and gluons couple weakly at very short distances. And the flip side of that is that the interactions are very strong at long distances, where long and short is all compared to 1 over lambda QCD at the length scale. That signifies the transition region between weak coupling and strong coupling. And we've done a few applications so far. The first application was when you started with particles that don't interact strongly, E plus E minus, and then the final state contains strongly interacting probabilities. And we use the difference of time scales to factorize that and the final probability that was non-perturbative because we summed over all final states was 1. The second application involved what's sometimes called onium, bound states of heavy quarks, much heavier than masses, much larger than lambda QCD. And because they're heavy quarks bound together, they live on the part of the potential, the short distance part of the potential. And that's given in perturbation theory. It's a lot like electrodynamics. It's got a 1 over R in the potential. But then because of the color factors and the representation the particles are in and the type of bound state, after you sum over all the colors to replace it by a problem with a non-relativistic problem with no colors, you get a different factor in front of the Coulomb potential depending on the particular system you're interested in. We got 4/3 for QQ bar and we got a flip of a sign and a 2/3 in the case of 3 quarks. So we worked that out explicitly last time. And now we're finally going to face probably the most important application, which is the strong interaction particles lie in the initial state, bound up into some, yes? Two particular quarks inside the baryon.
Yes, thank you. So even though we focused on just one of those three possible interactions between all three quarks, what we focused on characterizes all of them.
Right, because it's an epsilon tensor that contracts all the indices. So if you did any pair, you'd get exactly the same answer. So that's sufficient for the two-body potential. Yeah, so we're going to face up to that. We're going to have to face up to this. Here we prepare protons. And we're going to imagine, of course, the center of mass energy of the part. So we've prepared protons. But what's really going on at the quark level is, let's say, a quark and an antiquark inside the proton are annihilating to make a Z. And this is a very high momentum, very short distance process or high momentum, high center of mass energy process because the Z mass is so large compared to the scale of lambda QCD. Lambda QCD is like 200 MeV, or a fifth of the proton mass, and the Z mass is about 100 times the proton mass. So we suspect we can do something, but already when we prepare the state, there's non-perturbative physics going on. These are bound inside the proton. So first of all, we should understand what a proton is, right, if we want to have any shot at this at all. The onium, the heavy bound states, we can think of just like at the first approximation, there are corrections as a non-relativistic bound state. But here, we can't even think about that in first approximation. And so how do we think about what a proton is? Well, one way to think about it is, what is it composed of? And we're doing quantum mechanics here. And we're working in a regime, and the constituents of the proton, the up quarks, down quarks, they're very light compared to the scale of strong interactions. In relativistic quantum mechanics, particle number is not conserved. And so your state could be a linear combination of states with different numbers of particles, where by particles I mean up quarks, down quarks, not the particles, not the hadrons you observe in nature, the things we talk about when we set up perturbation theory. But in the non-perturbative regime, perturbation theory is very, very far from the correct description of nature. And so what does the proton look like? Well, it's going to have the two up quarks and the down quark. They carry, if you'd like, the flavor that makes it have a certain isospin, which is certainly true. But then there's some probability of finding In addition to that, gluons, there's some probability of finding one up bar pair popped out of the vacuum, some probability of finding two pairs, 15 pairs, etc. It's a horribly, and gluons as well, it's a horribly complicated quantum state. It's very different than non-relativistic quantum mechanics, where hydrogen is an electron and a proton. You never have to talk about the other states popped out of the vacuum and the probability of finding them. The binding energy is so small compared to the energy associated with twice the rest mass of an electron, we don't have to think about pair production, and we don't. But now we have to face it. We're just stuck with it. It's just there. So inside the proton are also pairs of strange anti-strange quarks. Now, we can get away with not talking about the very heavy quarks, because we can imagine we go over to an effective theory where they're removed, and then their effects are taken into account with some operators, small effects, because they're very heavy compared to the scale of lambda QCD. So the net effect is the proton is some complicated object. It's got this basic element to it, and then you can have arbitrary numbers of quark-antiquark pairs, gluons, etc., and there's some amplitude. If you wrote the state as a linear combination of these states, it would be very complicated in this way. And here's something that'll really bug you. So, you know, you set up a theory. You really want the state that's nothing to be simple, right? You know, nothing should be simple. What's nothing? It's the vacuum state, the ground state. Well, the ground state is just as horribly complicated. It just doesn't have this starting point. It's got arbitrary numbers of quark, anti-quark pairs. Because this basis we started with in perturbation theory of quarks and gluons is very, very far from the real eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, because perturbation theory is not valid. So we're stuck with this way of looking at the theory that, I don't know, it's just so very far from nature. Even the vacuum phrase in terms of quarks and gluons is some horribly complicated mess. Yes?
So is it even right to speak of particles in this regime?
Well, I mean, I think it's okay. We have this. There certainly are. There's all. So the real definition of a particle is it's a, you know, they're the asymptotic states in the theory, the real eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. And so the quarks and gluons, they're not that. They're just a tool to set up perturbation theory about that point. But you can do that. You can set up perturbation theory about that point. Or try to. Okay, so what's going on here? What we really need to know, so these partons, the ups quarks, the down quarks, the anti-quarks, the gluons, the partons, they're inside the proton. And they carry, you know, some sort of momentum inside there. And so we got to decide what the relevant degrees of freedom are for the problem. So we're going to work in the center of mass frame. It's going to help us think about it. So we have to make this very heavy Z. So the proton and antiproton are coming barreling into each other with a very large momentum along the beam direction. The quarks, antiquarks, gluons are bound inside those two protons, of course. So they carry a large momentum in the longitudinal direction along the beam. And transverse to that, they can carry some momentum set by lambda QCD. But it seems like this transverse degree of freedom should be irrelevant for the problem. It's some very tiny part of the momentum. It shouldn't matter for any of the physics. And so we're going to set up the problem neglecting that momenta and just talking about longitudinal momenta. Momenta along the beam direction. And so if I have a particular parton, there's some probability of finding it carrying some fraction x of the proton's longitudinal momenta. We're going to treat the proton as massless, the quarks are as massless, etc. So if it's a fraction of momenta, it's a fraction of energy as well. And so for each of the partons, I'm going to call that probability Well, it's actually more like a number density, except I don't think any book ever calls it. To me, it's a number density, and you'll see why in a moment. But everybody calls it a probability density, so I will too. So that'll become clear in a moment. So we're going to introduce, for example, U of X, dx. And sometimes you put a subscript p here. And that's going to be the probability of U quark carrying momentum fraction x of the proton's momentum. So this is a probability, which means this is a probability density. And I actually think it's the number density of U quarks. I think this is just how we say it. You'll see what I mean in a moment. Maybe I'm wrong, but I. Okay, and then we'll do the same thing for the other ones. Everything the same except D quark. This is a gluon. And then there's U bar P, probability of a U bar quark, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we're going to call these probability densities by the name of the particle. And sometimes if I want to denote an arbitrary particle, I'll just call it F, maybe sub P of X. And then we'll sum over S that go over all of these things, U, U bar, D, D bar. So that seems like the relevant quantity that we should be focusing on. And of course, sometimes you might have not free protons, but nuclei, and they contain protons and neutrons. And so you might want similar things for the neutron. So you could have, and sometimes you collide protons and antiprotons. So you'd want similar things for the antiproton. And that's all carried by this index here. But usually we don't write that index down because the initial states involve the neutron, the proton, and the antiparticles. And the neutron and proton are related by just changing up quarks to down quarks. And the particles are related by charge conjugation. And so they're all related to the one in the proton. Yes?
Sorry, kind of ignorant question.
It's not that it takes us too far afield. It takes us outside my expertise. But you have to have another. You have to have protons. You have to make a collision, and then you get some antiprotons, and then you have to collect them in a beam with a magnet that sort of separates them, and it's a complicated process. And then they put them in a collector ream, and they gather them, and they have to. I think it's called cooling. They have to get them down so they all have basically a single energy. It's really a very complicated process beyond my the things I feel comfortable talking about, actually. Yeah, sorry, I should really know more about what the experimentalists do. Yeah, sometimes, you know, when you're a theorist, you think, you know, we're like the, you know, somehow, you know, we understand renormalization, et cetera. Those experimentalists, they don't know about, really understand renormalization. It makes you think that in some sense you're better or deeper. We couldn't build a detector. No chance. I couldn't figure out how to cool protons. There's no way. And it wouldn't matter whether I tried, you know, we just have somehow different, our strengths are a little different. But there's no smarter or deeper this and that. Okay, so what do we really do? So, for example, if I have, I'm going to call U of X equals U proton of X. So when it's in the proton, I don't write the subscript. But then, for example, if I write down if I want u in the neutron of x, that's equal to d in the proton of x, because it just comes from flipping ups and downs, at least if we neglect the small things like electromagnetism that violate and the small quark masses that violate that symmetry. And so if I want the u quark distribution in the neutron, that's the same as the down. And if I want the u bar in an antiproton, for example, that's the same as u, the u in a proton. And so basically, we don't really have to write down this subscript, at least if we work in the limit where isospin is a good symmetry. In all the cases we're interested in, we can just use in the proton and use relations like this to get us back to those other states. Is that clear? So I'll stop writing subproton. Of course, the cases we're going to deal with involve the protons, but it's important to understand how to handle the other cases. Everybody with me so far? Now, these distributions, number densities or probability distributions, depending on how you want to say it. I would prefer to say number densities, but they don't let me. They satisfy certain sum rules. Sum rules come from when you integrate them over all x. So there's a quantum number, proximate quantum number called strangeness. Well, it's broken by the weak interactions, which just counts the number of strange quarks minus anti-strange quarks. Right? If you have strong interactions, the vertices preserve strangeness. If you want to define it as a symmetry on the Lagrangian, the S quark goes to e to the I alpha, the S quark. So U1 symmetry. And when you do this, the up and the down, they don't transform at all. They carry no strangeness. Everybody with me? So you could say under the charge, the strange quark carries charge 1. Well, it's charge minus 1, I think, is actually the convention. And then the anti-strange quark carries charge 1. They have opposite strangeness. So the proton has no strangeness. It's got isospin. It's got electromagnetic charge, but it's got no strangeness. So that implies the following. Oh, I should take these notes with me in case I screw up. It has no, so the proton has strangeness 0. It's not strange. Wouldn't it be peculiar if it's better? Has strangeness 0. So what does that tell me? It tells me if I integrate dx and I take s of x minus s bar of x, what am I supposed to get?
0.
Okay, who was the first to say 0? Yeah, of course you just understand. Look at all these quarters. I better ask a lot of questions today. Well, that was kind of like a hardball, right? So close, I threw it so hard. Anybody want to fancy another sum rule? Well, what's the charge on the proton? The charge on the proton is 1. So if we put in there the number of up quarks times 2/3 minus the number of down quarks times 1/3, down minus anti-down, actually, because you have all these pairs popped out as well. Oh, I have to introduce another piece of notation, actually. So sometimes these quarks here, the ones that are always there, they're called the valence quarks. And the other ones are called the, they used to be called the C quarks, but then charm quark was discovered, so that seemed a little inappropriate. Well, actually, I don't know which happened first. They used to be called the C quarks. Sometimes people call them the ocean quarks, so you don't get confused with the charm quark. They float around in the sea, these quark-anti-quark pairs popped out of the vacuum. Okay, so I'm going to have 2/3 u minus u bar minus 1/3 d minus d bar minus 1/3 s minus s bar equals 1. And as I mentioned before, we're writing a theory without the heavy quarks in it. That's what we're calling the effective theory of QCD. And if they were there, we could, if we wanted to put them in, we could put them in. Okay, so we can get rid of this one because we already know it's zero. What's the neutron charge? It's zero. So the neutron charge is the down quark is two-thirds the up quarks in the neutron, but that's like, but that's the d distribution because it's in the proton. So what could we do? Well, I could multiply this one by 2 and add these two to get rid of the downs. You with me, class? So if I multiply this by 2, that gets rid of the downs. So what do I get? I get dx from 0 to 1. I get 4/3. Yeah. And then I get minus 1/3 u minus u bar is equal to 2. So I get integral dx from 0 to 1 u minus u bar is equal to 2. That's the two quarks in the proton that I mentioned before. Net two quarks. There could be a gazillion up quarks. But most of them are paired up with quark-antiquark pairs, and you're left with this 2. And similarly for the downs, you get 1. So that helps us understand again what the proton is made of. Yes?
So in the charge expression for the neutron, why do you use the down quark?
Because this is the down quark distribution in the proton, which is the same as the up quark distribution in the neutron. When I don't write the subscript here, it always means in the proton. You're welcome. Yeah, I'm supposed to answer your questions. That's what I get the big bucks for. Well, the total momentum fraction should add up to 1 carried by everything. And so, oh, we got to put an x because we're doing momentum fraction. So these things, they can be measured, the parton distributions. They're universal in the sense that they have to do with the proton. They have nothing to do with the hard collision. So for example, when I do proton-proton to Higgs plus anything, it's exactly the same parton distributions that you use. They have to do their properties of the proton. In fact, the discussion I've given you is somewhat heuristic. You can give a real mathematical derivation. And what happens, using the operator product expansion again, and what happens is that these things are related to matrix elements of operators inside the proton state. So you don't have to be heuristic the way I was in this class. You can give a mathematical derivation. And, well, I encourage you to take a look at those things. You'll probably find one. Yeah? Right, fraction of the proton's momentum carried by the parton. So a given, so you can find, for example, gluons in the proton that carry most of the proton's momentum. There's some part of this complicated state where that happens. It ends up, if you go to lower x, the gluon distribution rises rapidly. So gluons and also the ocean quarks tend to be dominated at low x, carrying small fractions of the proton's momenta, while as the valence quarks, when you go out to very large x, you pick out mostly of the valence quarks. But you can go online and you can look at the graphs of the parton distributions. It's kind of fun to look at them, and it gives you a lot of intuition for hadronic physics at the LHC. Yes?
I get this relationship really kind of tell you that it's a number density.
Right. That's why I always want to call it number density, but every time I look at a textbook, they call it a, so I never really understood that. But this is a puzzle for me from when I was your age. But, you know, somehow, if you go to some talks, they'll call it a probability distribution, and so now you've heard the words the way everyone says them. Okay. So let's go on. Yeah?
Is it that they call probability because it's just that the quantum state only tells you what happens if you do a measurement and not specifically what the state is of a system? So it doesn't mean to say, well, it's just expressing the probability of finding something instead of the actual state of the system.
Well, if it was a probability density and you integrate it, you'd get one. That's the way I look at it. But let's not argue about the name. You know what it is now, what it means. You know, I'm on the losing side of that battle, so I don't want to fight it, because here I am, the one number density guy. But I'm teaching the class, so I'll tell you what I think. Bye. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to view the collision the following way. We're going to say, okay, now I've got the probabilities of finding these partons inside the hadron, and that's all I need to calculate this collision. After that, it's a really short distance process for the collision. We let it happen, and we calculate the rate for that. And then, of course, in the end, everything hadronizes, but we don't worry about that except for the Z. All the rest of the, you know, the quarks left over from the debris and the protons after they collide, that all does its stuff. We don't worry about it. That's similar to what we did before. So we got to calculate this. We want to get a formula calculating this cross-section for this process. Hopefully I'll finish that today. And that should, maybe we'll do a little more. Everybody with me so far? Okay, so if we're thinking about the Z, and we're going to work to lowest order in the weak interactions, then, or the lowest order in perturbation theory, let's say, the perturbation theory, that's the long distance perturbation theory, the hard process. So how could we, how could we make a Z? Well, there's sort of simple ways at tree level. You can make a Z like this, and similarly for the other quarks. There's more complicated processes, where this is a gluon, where you make a Z plus gluon. There's also radiative corrections to this process. There's also loop corrections. So there's even, you know, you could even take two gluons, for example, inside the two protons, and out could come, for example, a quark and an antiquark, and off could come the Z from here. Lots of ways. But this is the hard subprocess, the hard collision characterized by alpha S at mz squared, which is small. Like 0.1. And so we're going to work to lowest order in perturbation theory, and that's just this diagram. So that's all, and then there's plus corrections, of course, but we're going to neglect them. So we're going to have some invariant matrix element that you know how to calculate, because this is the same diagram that you calculated to get the Z decay width to UU bar, something you've already done. And in fact, the momenta here that go into this, they'll be exactly the ones, except for a minus, except they'll be similar to the ones for a Z decay, because, you know, we have a delta function at the vertex that conserves energy and momentum. So this process will be related to the decay process. So let's think about that. So we want to calculate for the process UU bar goes to Z, We want to calculate some average matrix element that I'm going to call this, where we average over initial spins and colors, and then we just sum over everything, just like we did in all the cases before. So the average over initial colors is a ninth, three colors for each of the quarks, a quarter for the spins, and then we sum over everything. The invariant matrix element square. So this is the thing that goes into calculating the cross section. We'll come to that in a moment. Let's just compare and contrast it with the z decay rate to these states, or any of them, u's, downs. What should I call these? I'm going to call them here I and I bar, where I is the type of quark. You with me, everybody? So this is a half times a half for the two spins, and this is a third times a third for the three colors. And then when I want to calculate gamma z goes to I plus I bar, so if I look up the formula for our space, that's 1 over 16 pi mz. So this is sum over everything, over colors and spins. Well, in this case, what I do is I average over the z spins. Here I sum over them in the final space. There's no a third for that. And then I sum over everything, m squared. Treating the quarks as massless. So you see the same thing occurs on both sides. And so what I get is 1 over 16 pi m. So what am I trying to do? I'm trying to relate this to this one. And so I get a 36 over 3. That's a 12. So this thing that occurs in the cross section, the thing that occurs in the cross section is just this average of m squared that I wrote in this way. That's 4 pi mz over 3 times the width. So here we've learned something really important right away. This production process, the rate for this is going to be proportional to the width for the decay of the z into that final state, something you've already computed. So the rest is kinematics. So let's do the rest. Everybody, what is the rest, you might be wondering? Okay. What is the rest?
Final states, the I bar, could you remind me what those
are? So I could be U quark,
right,
or down quark, or strange quark, and that's all that will matter in this case. Because the charm quark and bottom are allowed, but the probability of finding them inside the
right
proton is very small. Yes?
Okay, sorry, it's too early in the morning. How do we get a ninth in the first line and a third in the second line?
Okay, this ninth is colors of initial quarks. So each one has three, so you get a ninth. This is spins of initial quarks. And this is spins of the z.
Oh, right, okay.
So for different processes, let's say we were doing something different, like glue to Higgs. This factor here would be different from these things. This would become m Higgs, but it would also be Higgs to I plus I. And you just got to know the degrees of freedom to be able to figure out that factor in the individual cases. Okay, so.
Sure. Just since we haven't, I don't recall seeing this before, the m squared that it looks explicitly like a matrix element is just the spin average.
Yeah, this one here.
And color average.
This one, which one? There's so many M's.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So this thing with brackets denotes this particular averaging. But in the Z, another averaging comes in with just a third in the decay rate of the Z. They're all related to this invariant matrix element that you calculate. Is that okay? Yeah, look at all the things. So here, the Z spins are still summed over, but they're summed over in their final state, so there's no average over them. So every time, like if you do glue to Higgs, then you'll get like, you'll get, there's 8 gluons for each of them, you'll get 8 times 8, 64. So every case, for the different cases can be different. But here, it's all quarks. That's all we're considering here. And so it works for any of those states. Okay. I don't like that giant eraser like this one. I'm fearful of the giant eraser. It's an irrational fear. Maybe I need a shrink. Yeah, probably not.
Sometimes it jumps at you.
Pardon?
Sometimes it jumps at you.
The eraser?
Yeah.
My God.
It's not very stable.
Okay, well, that maybe it's not so irrational then. Yeah. Okay, so we want to calculate sigma. I guess I have 100 different notations. Unfortunately, this is me. What can I say? So when I originally wrote down the cross section, I called the initial particles A and B. So now I'm going to copy down that formula basically. So I'm going to call it A and B. Here it's I and I bar. Is this going to bother you, class? Okay. So we got A plus B goes to Z, and according to what we wrote down before, that's you divide by the flux factor. And then you have these integrals over final state momenta. Here it's just the Z. That's all there is in the final state at the parton level. Then we have this appropriately defined invariant matrix element square, and then we get the energy momentum conserving delta function. Everybody with me? So here, there's only one particle, the Z, in the final state at the parton level. It's kind of peculiar. No one ever talked to you about cross-sections with just one particle in the final state, and for good reasons, too. But let's just keep it going. So energy times four velocity is a momenta. Oh, thank you. Who was that? Is that Unicole? Okay. Well, it's okay. So we're going to do this. Well, how many 2 pi's do I have? I got 1 2 pi left over. Okay, I'll put that. Yeah. Got 1 2 pi left over. And then I'm going to write this as d4p times the delta pz squared minus mz squared. And so I'm going to get a delta function. So pz is pa plus pb. Where did I put the, I don't know, it's crazy notation. So these are massless particles. So P is E, they're incoming head on. And so I get 2 pi and I get 4 times 2, I get 8 EA, EB. See, am I at all consistent with, yeah, sometimes I put the square outside. It's crazy. I'm crazy. Sorry. You know what I mean? That's that spin average thing we defined before. Okay, well, nobody measures delta functions. If you write down a cross section and the answer is a delta function as a theorist and hand it to an experimentalist, you know, they'll kick you in the pants and throw you out of their office. Yes? Okay, so this is the momentum along the beam direction. And so they're incoming, so this one's opposite in sign than this one. And PB is the same as EB because they're massless particles. So I just, each of these is EA, EB. This one's minus that, so they add together. Is that clear? But the reason we can get away with writing a formula with a delta function here is that I forgot to is that we're not done. A and B are these partons, these up quarks. In the end, we have to integrate. We have to give them incoming. Okay, sorry. You wouldn't think it would be so hard for me to say this, but what do we have to do? Well, PA is the incoming parton, an up quark or an anti-up quark. And the thing that we really create is a proton. And so it carries some fraction of the proton's three momentum, and therefore four momentum if everything's massless. And so let's call that fraction x1, and the momentum k1 is of the proton, one of the protons, and the proton coming in the, and pb could be x2 of the other proton, with momentum k2. And so these are the proton momentum, and so k1 dot k2 is equal to the center of mass energy squared divided by 2. Because k1 plus k2 squared is the center of mass energy. And k1 squared is 0, k2 squared is 0, so you get this.
Should that be a plus sign?
Pardon?
Should that be a plus sign or last
time? This last one?
No, last the line after that. In the bracket.
I've got sign issues today. I've got a sign problem. Not a sinus problem, but a sign problem. In fact, and also EA and EB are just equal to x1 e center of mass divided by 2 and x2 e center of mass over 2. So now we can relate these parton variables to the momentum fractions x1 and x2 and the hadronic variables relevant for the collision. So still at the parton level, but using the hadronic, but using the x's and the hadronic variables. Still at the parton level. K1 and K2 are the proton momenta. So there's also proton, absolutely right. And these are the fractions. So there's two protons, one going in one direction, one going in the other. And the partons, they can carry different fractions because they're in different protons of the individual proton's momenta. And then, of course, we have to, we're coming to the end. We're not there yet. I got time. I'm not going to mess this up. Okay, so let's continue with our cross section. So I had 1, 2 pi in the numerator. Let's continue. So I got 1, 2 pi in the numerator. And then I had an 8 And I get x1, x2, e center of mass squared. This is the proton center of mass, the real center of mass of collision divided by 4. Then I got this crazy average thing, very scientific notation. And then I got delta here. So this thing in the argument here is PA squared plus PB squared plus 2 PA dot PB. But we're treating everything as massless. So this goes to, well, not to Z. This goes to 0. This goes to 0. So you just get 2 PA dot PB. And so what is that? That's x1, x2, e center of mass squared. Okay, here we go. What do we have to do to get this? Now, what we really want is this. Why do I want P? No. Because 2 PA dot PB is E center. Yeah, I always confuse that too. Don't feel bad. Okay, so the real thing we want is not this up anti-up or down anti-down, but we want protons. We want protons. So, oh shoot, I used the eraser from hell, the demon eraser. So what do we have to do? Well, we have to sum over all the possible parts, kinds of partons that could participate in the collision. Up quarks, down quarks, strange quarks, they're anti-quarks. So I'm going to label that by I. Then we have to integrate over the momentum fractions that they could carry, sum over them, because we have to sum over them, and that's an integral times a density. So then we have to put in the density. So there's Fi of x1, Fi bar of x2. So in this sum, so I, what does I go over? I goes over U, D, S, U bar, D bar, S bar. So when this is U, this is U bar. When this is u bar bar, will become u. So that's the notation I've introduced here. And that's because it's a u and a u bar quark that can annihilate, not two u bar quarks, for example. Yes?
You've been writing out sigma of a plus b to z, and now you're writing sigma of b plus b.
Right. So these were the partons. And once I've got this cross section, what I'm going to do is just sum over all the possible partons that could collide, and then get the probabilities that for each given momentum fraction, multiply by that to end up with the total rate.
I'm just wondering how the plus dot 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 showed up.
So the plus dot 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 showed up, for example, because we've got protons, right? And When they travel through each other and this hard collision takes place, they'll break apart. There'll be tons of other stuff in the final state. So it's the remnants of these protons and however it hadronizes. Is that clear? There's also higher order at the parton level, of course, which I talked about at the beginning, but we're not working higher order there. So we get Fi bar. Then we get this invariant matrix element squared, which is, okay, let me keep going, sorry. Don't worry about whether the square is inside or outside here. And then we get the delta function. This is someplace else. And And then we get the we got to put in the delta function. Okay, so what's going on here? I think I should have written another line here. I've confused myself now. Let's do another line here before this next one, and then we'll straighten up the next one. I'm sorry. So this one's equal to pi over x1, x2, e center of mass squared times this m squared times this delta function. Okay, so what have we learned here? So now we want to, so what I'm going to get is I'm going to get pi, and this factor in the denominator will just become mz squared because of the delta function. And then I can replace this by the other board. So what was that equal to? Where are you, other board? That was equal to 4 pi mz over 3 times the gamma. Hold on, I'll get you in a second. Okay. In the end, we're going to integrate this. We have a delta function, so I can make that replacement. So this becomes equal to the sum over I integral dx1 from 0 to 1, integral dx2 from 0 to 2, 4 pi squared over 3mz gamma z goes to I plus I bar times this delta function.
Sorry, how did that limit of integration change?
What change? I don't see any change. Okay, it agrees with my notes. What do we do next? Well, we can do for free one of these x integrals with the delta function. So we'll just do one of the x integrals, and then we have the final formula. And I put in a lot of steps this time because I think it's important to see the steps. Oh, I probably got more boards here. Hold on. Oh, yeah.
So what happened to the FIs?
The what? Left them out.
And the delta function has an e sub c m squared.
And he's, sorry. Obviously, it's not my day today. Thank you. Okay, so let's do the integral. Which one do you want to do?
Ha ha.
Kind of symmetric in the two x's. That's a physics joke. Some say we lack humor, but I scoff at those folks. Okay, so what do I get? I have the 4 pi squared over 3mz. I'm going to still have to sum over I. We'll do x2, so I'll have dx1. And where is it going to go from? Well, the lower limit now will be mz squared over e center of mass squared. And it'll go up to 1. And I'll get dx1 over x1. And I'll get fi of x1 and fi bar of mz squared over e center of mass squared x1. I'll get gamma z goes to I plus I bar. And like with the x1 downstairs, there's also an e center of mass squared. Just from the usual formula with delta functions that you differentiate the coefficient of the thing you got the delta function for. And so this is gamma z goes to gamma p plus p goes to z plus x at the order we're working, where x is all this other stuff, hadronic stuff.
Why does that become a gamma instead of sigma?
This gamma here?
On the left-hand side of the
equation. Oh, it's a sigma. Jeez, what's wrong with me this morning? Thank you. Maybe it's fear of my mother. I'm off to visit my mother later today. I don't know. Sorry about all the... Okay, that was cool, don't you think? It was fun, but all the news is about the Higgs. So we got to do P plus P goes to Higgs plus X, right? If we want to be topical, and everybody wants to be topical. There'll be a similar formula, a very similar formula. There'll just be some factor, depending on what was averaged over in the initial state, and a different decay rate to calculate. Mm-hmm. Well, okay, so how do you get the number that you compare with experiment, you're asking? So people have measured these parton distribution functions, and they're listed in files, which you can, you know, mathematical files, which you can download. It's a CTEC group. So what you have to do to get the final answer, the number you compare with experiment, is you have to download those files, and... So they're functions, they're tabulated. It's not like it's an analytic function. They're fit to data. Because and you have to do this integral numerically. So as far as a theorist is concerned, this is as far as I can go with the formula analytically. That's why it's the final answer for me, but you're right. It's not the final thing that matters. Okay? Yes?
When I worked on some experimental stuff, there were... multiple versions of parton distribution functions floating around. What's the difference between them?
Okay, well, part of it is just, you know, how do you do the fit? Right? What data do you use to do the fit? And there's another subtle aspect that I haven't talked about, which is you go to higher orders in perturbation theory, it ends up that these develop subtraction point dependence, which is canceled by subtraction point dependence here. But that's at that's beyond the order we've worked here, so and this formula wouldn't apply anymore at those orders. It's a different formula. It always applies the relationship to the width wouldn't apply necessarily. It always applies at the level of partons where you calculate the parton level and then do this integral. So yeah, there's different fits, and the reason you can get them is, of course, that they're properties of the proton independent of the underlying hard process. So you can measure many different hard processes and extract them. And you know, when you measure them at Fermilab, it's the same parton distributions apart from this subtraction point dependence, which I haven't really talked about here. Maybe it'll be in part two of the class. Yes?
Can I just ask, how do your lower limit change? From zero to step number?
Well, it's because of the delta function. You can't satisfy it when you go below there. Oh. Any other? Yes?
Probably missed something, but how can we decay in Z plus X? Didn't we use it only decay in Z?
This plus X is because now we've gone over to the physical process. We had two protons. Out from those protons, we picked an up quark, let's say, and an anti-up quark. But the rest of the protons there, it will materialize as hadrons. Most of it, you don't even see. It's like down the beam pipe, right? In the beam direction, you don't look there. But, you know, they're there, right? Plus, if I worked to higher orders in perturbation theory, you could have up quark, anti-up quark, making a Z plus a gluon. So there's also that aspect. So, and this is just the leading answer in perturbation theory for that formula. Any other questions? Okay, so let's start to think in the remaining minute about, so the next one we're going to do is Higgs production. And the great thing about this formula is that because it's related to the decay widths of particular final states, we're sort of talking about Higgs production and Higgs branching ratios or decays in the same time. You can do it all in one scoop. So how could we make the Higgs? So we could do up quark, anti-up quark, making the Higgs, and or down, anti-down, making the Higgs. This is at the parton level, how do we make the Higgs? But the Higgs couples proportional to the mass. And the mass and the up and down quarks are really large. What the quark that the Higgs couples a lot to is the top quark. But we've gone to this effective theory where the top quark's not there. There aren't very many top, anti-top pairs in a proton, right? It would be some horribly suppressed process. But the Higgs, nonetheless, we can make a Feynman diagram like this. And we can have the top quark here. And then out can come gluons. And this, because of the masses are so small here, and because the gluon distribution is so large at low values of x, this is actually what dominates the Higgs production rate. What dominates it is taking the gluons from the proton and from each of the protons and scattering them. So what we have to calculate, so there's different numbers in front, which you will have to do for yourselves. I mean, I'll write it down, but you'll have to figure it out for yourselves in one of the TA sessions. It's kind of a simple problem, but it's a good one. So we're going to calculate next class, or sketch the calculation, of the rate for the Higgs to go to two gluons in perturbation theory, just this Feynman diagram converted to a rate. And then we'll be able to calculate the production rate once you integrate over the parton distributions, yada, 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 at the LHC. The production cross-section. To get a rate, you have to multiply by the luminosities of the beams. Everybody good? Have a great weekend.